Just a quick disclaimer on this podcast, there may be some mispronunciations throughout the episode. Please do let me know if anything is cited wrong and you have any clarification or corrections you wish to make to what was mentioned in this podcast. I will then correct it in the next episode. I do apologize again for any mispronunciations of any of the words. I am English, it's very hard to sometimes pronounce things, so I apologize in advance. But without further ado, guys, please do enjoy the episode. Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Scotland, Episode 3, The Rise of the Picts. Now just a quick recap of where we left off last time. Last week we obviously touched on the Hadrian's Wall and Antony's Wall with the Caledonians' invasion, past Antony's Wall forcing the Romans to retreat to Hadrian's Wall itself, and then obviously learn about more about the tribes around the Caledonian area and how some were influenced by the Romans more so than others, and kind of the inter-tribe wars due to the Roman influence of southern Scotland. Now, the Picts were a confederation of Celtic-speaking peoples who lived in what is today eastern and northern Scotland during the late British Iron Age and early medieval periods. Where they lived and what their culture was like can be inferred from early medieval texts and Pictish stones. Just like what I mentioned last week, the history on this area can be very vague. The sources are either Roman or Anglo-Saxon, and with both of them hating the Scottish, the Pictish and the Caledonian tribes, they are very biased, so it's very hard to get a solid bit of history recorded on it. Early medieval sources report the existence of a distant Pictish language similar to the Caledonians, as again we mentioned last week, which today is believed to have been an insular Celtic language, closely related to the Brittonic spoken by the Britons who lived further down south. So we're talking Midlands, southern England. Picts are assumed to have been the descendants of the Caledonians, as we mentioned, and Pictland, also called Pictavia by some sources, achieved a large degree of political unity in the late 7th and early 8th century through expanding kingdoms that housed it to the west of the Scottish borders of Pictland itself. This resulted in Pictish overkingdom had merged with the Gaelic kingdom of Dal Reata to form the Kingdom of Alba, which we'll be getting into in future episodes, and by the 13th century obviously Alba had expanded to include formerly Brittonic kingdoms of the Isles of Strathclyde, Northumbrian, Lothian, Galloway and the Western Isles. That's all things we'll be picking up in future episodes, but just in terms of the timeline, as we said in the first episode, the Caledonians were tribes who helped fight off the Romans. The Pictish Confederacy was then formed out of those Caledonian tribes. Then a king was picked, and then the Kingdom of Picts was born. Then obviously the Picts would reign up until the 900 AD-ish, where it would later transform into the Kingdom of Alba, then the Kingdom of Scotland. So really this is where we start seeing a bit more of structure in the kind of the entire Britain area. As we know in history, all the province of Britannia was very tribe heavy. None of them were very united, similar to any Germanic tribes, and this is kind of the first time when we start seeing a united front in Scotland. They are still split into zones, so the Pictish lands and the Pictish kingdom are kind of middle Scotland, southern Scotland. You've got the north of Scotland, which is the Gaelic kingdom of Dal Reata, and then you've to the west you've got the Isles, which are then housed by Caledonian tribes, I think, for the beginning, but then would eventually be taken over by the Vikings in the late 1800 AD, early 900 AD. Pictish society was typical of many Iron Age societies in Northern Europe, having a wide connections and parallels with neighbouring groups. As we know, Pictish tribes were similar to Brittonic tribes down south, and Brittonic tribes were similar to Gaelic tribes in Gaul and Germania, so they all followed a similar gods structure in their lands, you know, the heavy farming presence, raiding, etc. Very little is known in the way the Pictish writing has survived. Pictish history since the late 6th century is known from a variety of sources mentioned Anglo-Saxon sources, early late Roman sources, and then Christian monks slash missionary sources as well. A Pictish confederation was formed in late antiquity from a number of tribes. How and why is not known. Some scholars have speculated that it was partly in response to the growth of the Roman Empire, in response to how the Caledonians were struggling. The Pictish Chronicle, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and the early historiographies such as Bede, Geoffrey of Monmouth, Holinshed, etc., all present Picts as conquerors of Alba from northern Scotland. However, no credence is now given to that view. Pictland has previously been described by Roman writers and geographers as the home of the Caledonii. These Romans also used other names to refer to tribes living in that area, but they may have heard these other names only second or third hand from speakers of Britannic or Gaelic languages, who may have used different names for the same group or groups. Pictish recorded history begins in the early Middle Ages, at the time the Gaels of Dal Rhita controlled what is now northern Scotland as part of a kingdom straddling the sea between Britain and Ireland. The Angles of Bernicia, which merged from Deira to form Northumbria, overwhelmed the adjacent British kingdoms, and for much of the 7th century, Northumbria was the most powerful kingdom in Britain. The Picts were probably tributary to Northumbria until the reign of a certain Pictish king in 685 AD. The Angloans suffered a defeat at the Battle of Dun Nacheton that halted their northward expansion. The Northumbrians continued to dominate southern Scotland for the remainder of the Pictish period. So in terms of the history around this time, we know that the Pictish area, when the Romans eventually left, formed, would take over southern Scotland, but when Northumbria themselves would become a strong Anglo-Saxon petty kingdom, from there Northumbria would continue to invade the north of the south of Scotland, take over that land, and even when they were able to repel Northumbrians, Northumbria would still control southern Scotland. And to be fair, this is a recurring theme that we'll see throughout the history of Scotland, is the English and Scottish borderlines change so much. We talked about how Hadrian's Wall marks the beginning and end of the Britain province in the Roman Empire, and in later history we'll see that change a lot with English invasions into Scotland, Scottish invasions into England, the conflict between the two, the wars between the borders. We'll see that quite a lot on that border change, but eventually, as we know, Scotland would take over southern Scotland and reclaim it and become a fully independent nation around that, up until the rise of King James and the merging of the English and Scottish crowns. So, the Viking Age also brought great changes into Britain and Ireland, no less in Scotland than elsewhere, with the Vikings conquering and settling in the lands and various mainland areas, including Caithness, Sutherland and Galloway. In the middle of the 9th century, this is said to be found in the Kingdom of the Isles, governing many of those territories, and by the end of that century, the Vikings had destroyed the Kingdom of Northumbria, greatly weakened the Kingdom of Strathclyde, and founded the Kingdom of York. In a major battle in 839, the Vikings killed the three kings and many others. In the aftermath, the new king in the 1840s, Kenneth MacAlpin, became king of Picts. During his reign, his grandson began to refer to the region as the Kingdom of Alba rather than the Kingdom of Picts, but it is not known whether this was because a new kingdom was established or Alba was simply a closer approximation of the Pictish name for Picts. However, though the Pictish language did not disappear suddenly, a process of Galicization was clearly underway during the regions and his successors. By a certain point, probably during the 11th century, all the inhabitants of northern Alba had become fully Galicized Scots, and Pictish identity was forgotten. Later, the idea of Picts as tribes were revived in myth and legend. Again, history sources are very vague around this area. It's very hard for us to judge where the Pictish line ends and the Albish Scottish line begins. So it's one of those where we have to take a bit of liberty with history and try and judge the myth and legends and try and convert that into an historical sense as best we can. The early history of the Picts is unclear. In later periods, multiple kings existed, ruling over separate kingdoms, with one king, sometimes two, more or less dominating their lesser neighbours. The Pictish Chronicle, along with Irish legends, have been used to argue the existence of seven Pictish kingdoms. Kings ruled from 311 AD to 943 AD, when the formation of the Kingdom of Alba happened. Again, we'll be going into the idea of how the Kingdom of Alba was formed. And just to give you an idea how we're just going to structure this Kingdom of Picts episode, the plan is more of an overview, and then from here we're going to be diving into the Ninth Legion, the disappearance of it, then the end of the Roman occupation in Britannia as a whole, and then obviously starting on the Pictish Kingdom when the Vikings, pre-Viking invasion, so when the Northumbrians were around, and then also when the Vikings invaded themselves and how the Kingdom of Picts survived. And then from there, we're going to be jumping into the end of the Vikings and Saxon relations with the newly formed Kingdom of England alongside the rise of Alba itself. So those are kind of the next episodes, and I'm going to be arranging them into the next four. So the next episode will be the Ninth Legion, the Roman end, and so on. So the next four episodes, hopefully at the end of the probably 3 weeks, we'll be touching on the rise of Alba, the Kingdom of Alba, Kingdom of Scotland, and jumping into a bit more of a historical setting, which has a lot more sources and a lot more to go on. But I am spreading these out, as I said. I don't want to rush through this early history, so we'll be just taking our times through this. So, moving right back into it, for most Pictish recorded history, the Kingdom of Fortiu appears dominant, so much so the Kingdom of Fortiu and Kingdom of Picts may mean one and the same thing in the annals. This was previously thought to lie in the area around Perth and southern Strathearn. However, recent work has convinced those working in the field that Moray, a name referring to a much larger area in the Hybrid Ages than the country of Moray, was the core of the Kingdom of Fortiu. Picts are often said to have practiced matrilineal kingship succession on the basis of Irish legends and a statement in Bede's history. The kings of Picts, when Bede was writing this story, who indeed claimed the throne through their mother and daughter of an earlier Pictish king, so showing the line of succession, can also involve females, but you wouldn't see a female Pictish queen. It's just how the bloodline would follow through. In Ireland, kings were expected to come from among those who had a great grandfather who had been a king. Kingly fathers were not frequently succeeded by their sons, not because the Picts practice matrilineal succession, but because they were usually followed by their own brothers or cousins, more likely to be experienced men with the authority and support necessary to be king. This was similar to Tanistry. Now, this can be due to A, the Roman invasion, the Roman army, Hadrian's Wall, B, Northumbria, the invasion of Northumbria, and C, the Vikings and the Viking invasion. You need a strong person against all three of those type of enemies at different stages of history. So having a child king or having a young king who is inexperienced and doesn't know what he's doing can potentially lead your kingdom into ruin. So this is a nature that a lot of kingdoms early medieval ages adopted. The nature of kinship changed considerably during the centuries of Pictish history. While earlier kings had to be successful war leaders to maintain their authority, as mentioned earlier, kingship became rather less personalised and more institutionalised during this time. Kingship was still far in the future when Picton became Alba, but the support of the church and the apparent ability of a number of families to control the kingship for much of the period from the later 7th century onwards provided a considerable degree of continuity. In much of the same period, the Picts' neighbours, the other kingdoms, including the Kingdom of Northumbria, faced considerable difficulties as the stability of succession and rule that previously benefited them ended. The later Mormons are thought to have originated in Pictish times and to have been copied from or inspired by Northumbrian usages. It is unclear whether the Mormons were originally former kings, royal officials or local nobles, or some combination of these. Likewise, the Pictish shires and traces of which are found in later times are thought to have adopted from their southern neighbours. Again, Northumbria Vikings would have a great impact on Scottish history and the Kingdom of Picts themselves, and eventually the Kingdom of Albert. The archaeology records provide evidence of the material culture of the Picts. It tells of a society not readily distinguished from its British, Gaelic and Anglo-Saxon neighbours. Although analogy and knowledge of other so-called Celtic societies, a term they use for themselves, may be a useful guide, these extended across a very large area, relying on knowledge of pre-Roman Gaul or 13th century Ireland as a guide to the Picts of the 6th century may be misleading if something is pursued too far. As with most peoples in north of Europe in late antiquity, the Picts were farmers living in small communities. Cattle and horses were an obvious sign of wealth and prestige. Sheep and pigs were kept in large numbers, and place names suggest these transhumans was common. Animals were small by later standards, although horses from Britain were imported into Ireland as breedstock to enlarge native horses. From Irish sources, it appears that the elite engaged in competitive cattle breeding for size, and this may have been the case in Pictland also. Carvings show hunting with dogs, and also, unlike in Ireland, with falcons. Cereal crops included wheat, barley, oats, rye. Vegetables included kale, cabbage, onions and leeks, peas, beans and turnips, and some types no longer common, such as cicrete. Plants such as wild garlic, nettles and watercress may have been gathered in the wild. The pastoral economy meant that hides and leather were readily available. Wool was a main source of fibres for clothing, and flax was also common, although it is not clear if it grew its fibres for oil or as foodstuff. Fish, shellfish, seals and whales were exploited along coasts and rivers. The importance of domesticated animals suggests that meat and milk products were a major part of the diet of ordinary people, while the elite would have eaten a diet rich in meat from farming and hunting. No Pictish counterparts to the areas of denser settlement around important fortresses in Gaul and southern Britain or other significant urban settlements are known. Larger, but not large, settlements existed around rural forts, such as Burghead Fort, or associated with religious foundations. No towns are known in Scotland until the 12th century. This is due to the lack of historical sources, credible historical sources, and towns constantly being raided, destroyed, moved, etc. The technology of everyday life is not well recorded, but archaeological evidence shows it to have been similar to that in Ireland and Anglo-Saxon England. Recent evidence has been found of watermills in Pictland. The early Picts are associated with piracy and raiding along the coasts of Roman Britain. Even in the late Middle Ages, the line between traders and pirates was unclear, so that Pictish pirates were probably merchants on other occasions. It is generally assumed that trade collapsed with the Roman Empire, but this is overstated the case. This is only limited evidence of long-distance trade with Pictland, but tableware and storage vessels from Gaul, probably transported up the Irish Sea, have been found. This trade may have been controlled from the closer Pictish kingdoms, where such goods appear to have been more common. While long-distance travel was unusual in Pictish times, it is far from unknown, as stories of missionaries travelling around these areas are shown. Picts are often to have tattooed themselves, but evidence for this is limited. Naturalistic depictions of Pictish nobles, hunters and warriors, male and female, without obvious tattoos are found on monumental stones. These stones include inscriptions in Latin, not of all which have been deciphered. The well-known Pictish symbols found on standing stones and other artifacts have defied attempts at translation over the centuries. Pictish art can be classed as Celtic and later insular. Irish poets portrayed their Pictish counterparts as very much like themselves. Again, the tribes that ended up leaving England when the Romans invaded would head north into Pictland, Caledonia, and also across the water to Ireland. So that's why you'll see a similarity between the two cultures and the two nations. If we move on to the religion side of things now, we know Christianity in the Roman Empire would later become the main religion, and so would go out the old religions of many gods, and we'd only then have one god, Jesus, etc. Christianity would eventually arrive in Britannia, and English provinces in that area would adopt it. This influence would then spread into closer Wales. Obviously, the Anglo-Saxons, when they would come after the Romans left, and Pictland themselves. Early Pictish religion is presumed to have resembled Celtic polytheism in general, although only place names remain from the pre-Christian era. The roots of Christianity in Scotland were probably among the soldiers and ordinary Roman citizens who lived in the vicinity of Hadrian's Wall. The archaeology of the Roman period indicates that the Roman parts of the Roman province of Britannia were among the most Christianized in the island. After the collapse of the Roman authority in the early 5th century, four major circles of influence emerged in northern Britain. In the east, the kingdoms of the Picts eventually stretched from the River Forth to Shetland. In the west were the Gaelic-speaking people of Dalreta, who had close links with Ireland, from where they brought with them the name Scots. In the south were the British, Brittonic-speaking descendants of the peoples of the Roman-influenced kingdoms of the Old North, the most powerful and longest surviving of which was Alcut. Finally, the Anglo-Saxons had overrun much of southern Britain and held kingdoms of Northumbria, which reached into what is now the borders of Scotland in the south-east. While the Picts and Scots would have remained pagan, most scholars presume that Christianity would have survived after the departure of the Romans among Brittonic enclaves and retreated as the Anglo-Saxons arrived north. Their gods included Ty, Woden, Thor, Frigg, all whom gave their names to days of the week, and Astro, whose name was appropriated for the spring festival of Easter. While British Christians continued to practice inhumation without grave gods, the pagan Anglo-Saxons are visible in the archaeological record from their practice of cremation and burial in urns, accompanied by the existence of grave gods, perhaps designed to accompany the dead to the afterlife. However, despite growing evidence of Anglian settlement in southern Scotland, only one grave has been found at Delamy in East Lothian. The traditional view of Christianisation of Scotland has seen it carried out by Irish, Scots, missionaries, and to a lesser extent those from Rome and England. Historian Richard Fletcher argued that motivations for these missions may have included the example of St. Patrick, the idea and growing interest in evil Gallianism. Missionaries from Ireland were operating on the British mainland from at least the 6th century. This movement is traditionally associated with the figures of St. Ninian, St. Ketigan, and St. Columba. However, historian Kilbert Marcus highlights the fact that most of these figures were not church founders, but were usually active in areas where Christianity had already become established, probably through gradual diffusion that is almost visible in historical record. This would have included trade, conquest, and intermarriage. This means and spread by which the Picts converted to Christianity is uncertain. Bede gives credit for the conversion to Ninian probably because in the 8th century, when Bede was writing, the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria was in control of the southwest of Scotland, and an English bishop was in possession of the see that theoretically had been Ninian's. Bede may have been reminded the Pictish church of its allegiance. Benedict Biscop, founder of two monasteries and one of the key figures in the adoption of Roman authority in Northumbria, the process of conversion may have begun earlier than traditional mission-based narratives. It is likely that knowledge of Christianity reached the region from Dalreta, which with it had close contacts including war, trade and intermarriage. Traditions place the 5th century Palladius in Pictland after he left Ireland and link Albert of V with his contemporary Saint Brigid of Kildare. Evidence for an early date for Christianisation include the fact that Saint Patrick, active in the 5th century, referred in a letter to apostate Picts, indicating that they had been previously been Christian but had abandoned the faith. In addition, the poem Why Godden does not remark on Picts as pagans. Recent archaeological work in place of these areas have found monasteries and foundations of monasteries there, an area once assumed to be among the last converted in the late 6th century. In the east and north, class 2 picture stones began to show Christian symbolization from the early 8th century. Conversion of the Pictish elite is assessed to have taken place over a considerable period beginning in the 5th century and not complete until the 7th century. Conversion of the general population may have stretched into the 8th century. The evidence of place names suggests a wide area of Lofan influence in Pictland, where there are large numbers of dedications of churches and abbots of the 7th century. Now, in Christianity themselves, it was a rocky start in terms of how it was introduced to Roman Britain. Obviously, Romanized Britain would become Christian. Once the Romans left, you would have the Anglo-Saxons invade, who brought across with them their paganism. They would then later convert to Christianity and use Roman buildings and follow a Roman way of life, a structured kingly way of life, which would go into early medieval times. And obviously, Wessex themselves would become the Kingdom of England, carrying over the Christianity as a religion and the Roman structure of feudalism. In Scotland, it was a little bit different. As you know, the tribes stayed and always did stay as the Gaelic Germanic religion that they were following, which meant the influence of Christianity was less strong. In southern parts of Scotland, they were obviously stronger than in northern parts of Scotland. But when eventually the Anglo-Saxons did convert to Christianity, that influence would rise further north, and as always, the kingdom to that related to Ireland, who Ireland had Irish missionaries, would later become Christian as well. So it was influence from Ireland, influence from England would help drive the force to become to transform Scotland to Christianity and for a Christian-based feudalized religion, although the feudalism would only become apparent in the early to middle ages in Scotland, as Scottish history is filled with old rules, tribal law, etc. And you'll see that up until about the 1200s, even when you have the kings of Scotland formed, there were still tribal laws, etc. that wasn't necessarily following the feudal system. Now, this episode has been more of an overview of the kings of Pict and the kingdom of Pict itself. Alright, what we're going to do is we're going to split this up into a few more episodes. The next episode we're going to be talking about the invasion of the 9th Legion into Scotland and the disappearance and the mythology behind that, and the Roman end in Britain, and discuss how the Romans left, why it was so abrupt, and obviously the Saxon invasion of Roman Britain. From there, the next episode we'll be touching on pre-Viking eras, such as the Kingdom of Northumbria invading Scotland and basically forcing the Kingdom of Pict to become their tributary, and then we'll touch on the invasion of the Vikings and the influence that had on the Scottish culture in the area. After that, we're touching on the Viking end and the Saxon relationships, English relationships that would become apparent in about 945 to 1000 AD. And then we can finally touch upon the rise of the Kingdom of Alba. Now, the Kingdom of Alba will be brought up quite a bit during these next few episodes, but if all intents and purposes, we're still going to refer to ourselves as the Kingdom of Picts, because we're still unsure if the Kingdom of Picts was the Kingdom of Alba, just the name changed and people started referring to them as a different people, or if it was a country change. But we'll be discussing that in a later episode, and when we get to the end of the Viking era and the end of the Saxon relationships and the formation of the Kingdom of England, we'll dive straight into the rise of the Kingdom of Alba, and then we can go jump straight into proper Scottish history, following ourselves all the way up into the Kingdom of Scotland and onwards. So each episode will be dragged out a little bit longer, and we'll be going more detailed in these episodes. At the moment, as I said, the sources are very hard to follow. It's very hard to judge what is a credible source and what isn't a credible source. So that is why we're doing more overview episodes at the moment, when we're covering a vast variety of topics. But next episode will be a fun one with the 9th Legion, and we'll try and jump into late antiquity and finish that off in the next episode, and jump into Saxon and Viking times following that. So as always, guys, thank you so much for listening to the podcast today. The podcast, again, is available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Thank you again for all the nice comments that you have left on Reddit and also the downloads that you've been given. It's good to see that this podcast has become very popular and probably the most popular Scottish podcast potentially out there. If you have any corrections that you wish to tell me, please comment below. Again, I apologize for some of the words I've messed up, some of the pronunciations that I messed up, and if there's anything that I've missed or not cited properly, please do let me know. I am always wanting to improve on my work, and as I go through these podcasts, hopefully my pronunciation of words and how the flow of the podcast will become a lot more structured and easy flowing. But I'm glad everyone's still enjoying it nevertheless. Again, next episode is on the Ninth Legion and the Roman End in Scotland and England. Other than that, guys, have a great week. Stay safe, and I'll see you all next week. Goodbye, guys.